Case number 21-1392, Crystal Robinson versus Quicken Loans. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Connor Gallagher for the appellant. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court.
Afternoon.
I have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you. Good afternoon. This is our appeal from summary dismissal, requesting that you reverse and remand the trial court's grant of summary dismissal on our Title VII claims. We brought retaliation, discrimination, and hostile workplace environment for the main, and I know Your Honors have read the briefs and you're very familiar with this case. However, I'm just giving you a little background at the moment. I'd like to start off with the first thing, and that's the hostile workplace retaliatory argument. That was not briefed, that was not discussed, and that must be reversed. There was no argument by defendant at the trial court level, and that was not discussed in the opinion of the court, and we ask that you reverse and remand that decision alone. We think there's ample evidence that has been displayed as to the hostile workplace environment from a retaliatory aspect, and as cited in my brief, the Sixth Circuit has allowed these types of claims to be pursued. That being said, taking you back now, this is...
Are you indicating that you believe your opposing party has waived or forfeited one of the arguments?
So I'm not naive enough to say that my opposing counsel will get up here and say that. However, after review of the record, you can see that at no point in the original briefing at the trial court level was there ever any discussion or any argument to dismiss the retaliatory hostile workplace environment. In fact, that analysis was not done once review of the actual opinion of the trial court. It's sua sponte decision that our entire claim be dismissed, and there was no analysis, and that was never brought. So I am saying that. However, obviously I understand that there were arguments made in this briefing that would kind of contradict that. However, I'm bringing you back to the trial court level, and that's just simply not the case. That argument was never brought.
But the trial court dismissed the claim, right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, it's in the opinion. So you're just saying they didn't ask for summary judgment on that?
It was not asked, and then, in my opinion, there's not really analysis into it. The hostile workplace environment does not go into the retaliatory aspect of it, if you read the opinion. If you see the way we brought the complaint, it is clearly in there. I said the case is cited even in the complaint of a retaliatory. However, it's only a hostile workplace environment claim. It's not a hostile workplace environment claim based on retaliation, hostile workplace environment. It's not pled that way. The facts are indicated in the actual complaint.
But the facts of the case at the trial level, the case was brought in response to the summary judgment motion addressed the plaintiff's complaint and the various facts that are a part of that complaint. Those facts are not siloed facts. Those facts are interrelated. And when the defendant at that time moved, for judgment on the plaintiff's complaint, which would be inclusive of all the claims raised in that complaint. Now, if the court did not go through and seriatim do an analysis on all of those, that's not fatal to their position, is it? If it is, why?
Sure, that's not my position. So, to answer your first question, it was brought as in all the analysis and the summary disposition was simply to the race and the sex. So, while yes, you are correct, they did bring a motion to dismiss our entire hostile workplace environment claim. There was no analysis in that motion that reflected that they were even requesting to dismiss the retaliatory aspect of it. It's akin to no them moving. It's the exact same thing. If they would have moved only to argue that our race hostile workplace environment claim should be dismissed. If they would not have brought an argument that says also the sex should, then I believe that the clear law would be that we would proceed to a trial on sex hostile workplace environment claim if no argument was raised as to that. I'm sorry. I think I answered your question, but maybe not.
Carry on.
But let me ask you this, though.
Yes, sir.
You keep saying the retaliatory workplace harassment claim. The harassment would have to be the same. It's the same acts of alleged pervasive harassment as you alleged with the work with the harassment claim itself, right?
It's similar. Yes and no, Your Honor. So it would be specifically as to the treatment because she was essentially, for lack of a better term.
Right, but one of the elements of the retaliatory harassment claim is pervasive harassment, right?
Yes, sir.
And that's the same as just a straight harassment claim or workplace environment claim where it has to be pervasive, right?
Yes, sir.
In other words, if the district court didn't think that my understanding or reading of the district court opinion was these acts don't rise, you know, looking at all of them, construing it in your favor, they just don't rise to the level of pervasive harassment, whatever. And that rationale would also cover the retaliatory claim too, wouldn't it? I agree. I understand you disagree with that, but wouldn't the rationale be the same?
But respectfully, Your Honor, that is exact. You raise my point. That's why these things can't be taken in a silo, as Judge Donald said. So when that analysis is being done, there obviously you've read our complaint, you've read our motion. There are a lot of facts in our situation that have to do with her race and a lot of facts that have to do with her sex. So when the judge is sitting there and analyzing our claim of whether or not it is pervasive, then those are the facts that are being considered, only what the facts that are antagonistic to her sex and gender. So that is why I believe it would have to be, and you have to go through these different analysis, because taking everything together as it's just not how these work. The actual hostility has to come from the protected class of what the hostile workplace environment is. So in our claim, in our situation, if you want to put some facts to it, our client testified ad nauseum about how she was being retaliated against, how no one that she knows has ever maintained their employment past.
So let me ask you this, and please forgive me for interrupting you, but when you're looking at the universe of facts that form this case, in the judge's consideration, what are the unique facts that you say the judge did not consider or analyze that make his disposition erroneous as to whichever claim? Because as Judge Nalbandian said, the facts, the same facts that form the pervasiveness or whatever, are the same facts that would go to these other claims. So there must be some fact or set of facts that the judge did not consider either appropriately or inappropriately. So what are those?
Sure, and I would just like to bring you back briefly to how the facts have to be centered around the actual protected activity. Right. The protected activity. So for instance, the facts that weren't analyzed are the fact that my client a few weeks before she was terminated walked up to her manager, asked her if she could discuss their working relationship. The manager looked at her in her face, walked out of the room and didn't say anything. That same day, she got an email that said, after she emailed her and said, can we work on this, manager emailed back, says there's nothing you can do to fix this relationship. My client was trying to transfer out of this place, and she had a great meeting with her new manager, Raphael, and she was just trying to wash her hands of the situation and just leave. None. When she came back to get with her onboarding paperwork, Raphael had a completely different tone change. Turns out Ms. Schaefer talked to him in between that time. Later that day, she was told she can't transfer. Next week, she's terminated. That is the soul of the case, and how when you look at these in vacuums and you look at just the harassment that is based on my client's sex or gender, or just the harassment based on my client's race, then it kind of all falls apart. Because then you can start, which I don't think is appropriate in the first place, as I've cited, but it's quintessentially a question of fact. We need to get these kind of things to a jury of our peers to decide what is the standard conduct that is appropriate in these kind of areas. And hostile workplace environment is one of the prime types of claims that is necessary for that, because it tells us what is an acceptable workplace. So when you look at just the comments raised on my client's sex, while I don't personally agree, and I don't think anybody should have to deal with any of that ever, a judge would be more likely to say, oh, that's a one-off passing comment. Now, when you're looking at everything in a whole, you can't really do that. It's not just a vacuum, it is everything, but just the pervasiveness as to the retaliation aspect of it, I think it's clearly present, and nobody, and it was never analyzed and never discussed. And most of my discussion there kind of centered, kind of brought, cued my retaliation argument as well, as I'm sure your honors have read the brief and are very familiar as well. And I would just like to...
Well, what do you have to show us that the adverse treatment your client allegedly received was frequent enough or severe enough? There are some small, I shouldn't call them small, but isolated instances that of alleged mistreatment here and there, some of which, quite frankly, were not very substantial in nature, and but to make out the hostile work environment and even the claims of discrimination, we would look to, and one thing we'd look at is how frequent were the instances and how severe were they. And for the most part, the largest, most substantial evidence in behalf of your client is her own deposition testimony. And in that, in the deposition testimony, when asked, she wasn't even clear that she wasn't certain, would be a better way to put it, that she was being discriminated against based on her race and sex. So what are the substantial, the evidence, if you have something of a substantial nature or frequent nature that you could point us to?
Yeah, sure, Your Honor. So it goes through everything she testified to, and I would like to push back on the point where she couldn't point out whether or not it was a discriminatory intent. And that testimony goes to her inability to speak to somebody else's intent. That's just is what it is. And that was in my reply, and I briefed it. If that was the standard, then we would be having we'd have to wait for Matlock moments to happen before we instilled any liability in any Title VII. And that's just simply not the standard here. But to directly answer your question, Your Honor, it's 4 years of being mansplained, 4 years of not being taken seriously in meetings, and 4 years of being asked to clean up in meetings, being asked to order food in meetings, but being told by her direct supervisor that the men here, they earn the right to act this way. It's a multitude of everything. And then in the light most favorable to us, I think it's pretty clear that we've at least raised that question. And then just one final point, Your Honor, I apologize. All of that is not really... germane to the analysis once you deal with the retaliation. And I think the retaliation and the hostile workplace environment were the two most egregious errors by the trial court that were very clear.
All right. I know you're out of time here, but let me ask you one final thing. The entire HR file, personnel file of your client, I don't believe was in the record in as a result of the discovery in the case, and I'm just wondering if why wasn't her entire personnel file requested in discovery? If it wasn't, there were supposed to be meeting notes relating to meetings she had with HR or with personnel people and all that. And so I guess what I'm saying is burden of proof was on you or your client, and it seems that some of the things are not in the record. Can you tell me why you didn't ask for that if you didn't?
Sure, we did, Your Honor, and I don't think that lack of a record keeping when the defendant's in sole custody and control of that record should cut against me in this situation. These meetings happened. They were testified to by both parties. Whether or not defendant kept notes of those meetings, I think that shows a guilty conscience, maybe. But either way, I think that highlights the impropriety of the summary dismissal, because we have to make an evidence or a judgment ruling, and that's not what we're doing. We're past the standard at that point. We became jurors, right? If we have to then decide where the evidence
Wait a minute. I'm not sure I understand your answer as to why you didn't obtain these things in discovery. If they weren't turned over, there were motions, you could have filed motions to compel and taken other measures, and that sort of information is pretty critical in a case like this, and it would appear that you didn't obtain it. And I was just asking why, and I'm not getting from you a good explanation.
We asked, and it wasn't provided, Your Honor. And
that doesn't mean anything. Yeah, that's why you have motions to compel and motions for sanctions and things like that in connection with discovery.
We were informed that that was the complete record, Your Honor. So we had to take that at its truth. And I would just like to point out that...
Who told you it was the complete record when you didn't have the... maybe a company of this size and magnitude doesn't create or keep such records on the employees, but that seems highly doubtful.
I'm not going to put a position on the credibility of the statement either way. That's what we were told. We were told we were given complete discovery, Your Honor, but I would just to point out that...
I think we have your argument at hand.
Very well, Your Honor. Thank you very much, panel. I appreciate it. And 4 minutes for rebuttal, if you don't mind.
Afternoon, counsel. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Cashin, appearing on behalf of the appellee, Quicken Loans, Inc., now known as Rocket Mortgage, LLC. The core here of this case is that we have an employee who has longstanding documented performance deficiencies and one final insubordinate act, and that's why she was terminated, and that's all. Now, there's no question that she had some conflicts with her supervisor, and who's also the decision maker. That's Bridget Schieffer. But she's also an African-American woman, just like the plaintiff. It's also, if you follow plaintiff's testimony, Ms. Robinson felt unappreciated in some of the meetings with her team members. And she can't point to anything that establishes that as being on the basis of her race or her gender. Really, you have a situation where she is sort of the new kid on the block. She's a business analyst. It's a non-technical position. And she is interacting with software engineers that have been there for many years and are highly experienced. And so there is some bumpy interaction between them if you accept what...
Can I ask you a question about the retaliation claim?
Sure.
And it's just not clear to me from the record. When was the first time she met with HR?
With HR itself, that's called the Pulse. It's March through May of 2018
Is it before she got the verbal warning or after?
Right around the same time.
Okay. I guess I'm a little bit confused with the way that discipline works, but there was a verbal warning, a written warning, and then termination. Were those warnings, under company policy, did she have to get those warnings before being terminated, or could she have just been terminated at any time?
She could have just been terminated. They try to follow a progressive discipline system, but it's not mandatory.
Okay, and then how do we analyze kind of the temporal proximity causation question in a progressive discipline case?
So what we have is, again, she receives this verbal warning in May of 2018, and she goes to talk to HR about that, and she has several discussions with HR right around that time frame. That's followed by her mid-year performance evaluation. That happens the end of August 2018, and that's where she is rated, needs improvement, and has some other comments from coworkers and whatnot in there. She drops the ball on some performance things. So right in that time frame as well is the written warning, which is the end of August, early September. And she then goes on this action plan, the equivalent of a performance improvement plan, right? And she's to be mentored. She's assigned a mentor that she doesn't meet with, all this stuff that you've read in the briefs. And so we have several months that go by between her talking to HR, the Pulse, back in May timeframe, and when she's terminated in October. And when she's terminated in October, it's because They found a new team for her to try and give her a fresh start, and they meet with her. Again, you've read that, right? They tell her that the expectations are, you've got to work a full day because she's coming in late and leaving early. And right after that meeting, she walks by and leaves early.
So why? I guess what I'm wondering is, if she meets with HR and they are going along, I mean, why is it not the case that the progressive discipline itself could be retaliatory? You wouldn't have gotten a verbal warning were it not for going to HR. You wouldn't have gotten a written warning. Or is it basically the point is that the termination itself is the only actual adverse employment action, and because the termination takes place kind of so far removed from the initial complaint, that's the answer.
I would argue just exactly that. All right? And I don't mean to say that warnings cannot be discipline that is equivalent to adverse action. All right? I'm not saying that. But really, in this case, the termination stands on its own, and there's no causal connection between that termination and her discussions with the HR folks.
But through the time of the progressive discipline, there was no, she didn't get a cut in pay, she didn't have her job responsibilities changed, she didn't, some of the things we would look at, I guess, for adverse employment.
Correct.
Okay.
And one of the points that is made, I'm sorry.
Wanted you to make your point, then I have a question for you.
Sure, I was just gonna say, one of the things you may have read in counsel's brief, where he argues, well, there was a meeting with HR which is contemporaneous with the termination. That is the termination meeting. When you read the notes of that, it's actually she meets with Ms. Schieffer and Mr. Brock and is given expectations, and that's when she walks out early. And within that same week, a couple of days, she meets with Ms. Schieffer and the HR folks from the Pulse, and that's where she's told that she's terminated, where they review her performance and talk about her having left early and tell her she's terminated. So he's conflating some things there is my point. So yes, Judge.
I wanted to ask about a statement that Ms. Robinson makes that really relates to her performance before Ms. Schieffer's maternity leave and after Ms. Schieffer's return. According to Ms. Robinson, during Ms. Schieffer's absence on maternity leave, she got along well with everybody, received high praise. Her performance was, I won't say exemplary, but her performance certainly was not problematic. And then it's her contention that after Ms. Schieffer returned, Ms. Schieffer basically entered into a papering of the record by writing her up and getting her on this performance improvement or disciplinary plan because Ms. Schieffer was concerned about some kind of competition between the two of them. I want you to address that allegation. Was her performance problematic before Ms. Schieffer's paternity leave or only after she got back from maternity leave?
Okay, so Ms. Schieffer becomes her supervisor in October of 2016. Mm-hmm. So she's her supervisor for an extended period, and there are issues for an extended period. And so, for example, those issues are documented in the 2017 performance evaluation. And so it is true that there
and
were...
And was counsel provided those records of the negative performance reflected in the 2017 record?
Well, sure. So the 2017 performance, that's in the record.
Okay.
You have that, as did the trial court and counsel. This business about the personnel file, I can't address that because I didn't handle that. Okay. Another
right.
attorney did.
Thank
and I,
you.
This is news to me that he's saying he didn't get documents or something.
What do you mean you can't address it? I mean, when you took over the case as counsel, I would assume you asked to see the employee's personnel file and all that sort of a thing. And if it wasn't there, you'd want to know why. I don't follow that you can't address it.
Your Honor, you're asking good questions.
Both of us can't talk at the same time. We We just can't do that. Why is it that you didn't familiarize yourself with where the file was, and if it was missing, why it was missing?
All I can say, Your Honor, is I focused on the documents in the record. That is, it had been presented to the trial court by opposing counsel and by the attorney in my office. So I'm sorry, I just don't have that information to provide to you.
All right.
In terms of the, there's an allegation of direct evidence. There's only one point there that counsel raises that bears discussion. And that is a plaintiff's testimony with regard to a discussion with Ms. Schieffer in which she gave an example that certain of her male colleagues in a meeting didn't respect a person with a different belief, and that Ms. Schieffer is alleged to have responded, well, they have proven themselves. That is not direct evidence. Direct evidence is evidence which, if believed, requires a conclusion that discrimination was a motivating factor, and that's not at all connected to termination, and it really is a reflection, if anything, of the fact, again, that we have an inexperienced business analyst dealing
about this argument about the retaliatory hostile work environment claim? Was that something that you moved on, or was that encompassed by your entire motion, or what's your response to that?
Okay, so look, that was not a separate count in the complaint. That's one paragraph within the retaliation count, all right? It's paragraph 126, and we move for summary judgment on the entire complaint, including the retaliation count. And so that's not only covered in the arguments on retaliation, but it's covered in the arguments on hostile work environment, and it fails for the same reason. So did we specifically point out in our motion, hey, look, this paragraph 126 is encompassed in this? No, we didn't. But we moved for summary judgment on that entire count that included that one paragraph that alleged a retaliatory hostile work environment. But again, that fails because, first of all, there's no causal connection showing between this alleged hostile environment and the complaint in this May timeframe to 2018 to the Pulse, the HR folks. And also, there's no showing that that it amounts to a severe, pervasive, hostile work environment that interfered with her job. Are there any other questions that I can address for you?
Apparently not.
I'll be the first to admit that some employee lawsuits have merit. This is not one of them, Your Honors. Just isn't. The trial court made the right decision and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any rebuttal?
So I'd just like to start off by, may I proceed? I'm just waiting on my time. I don't want to do anything improper. Thank you. I would just like to first point out there is no causal connection element in a hostile workplace environment claim, as I think everybody here knows. Quintessentially, a question of fact is exactly that in the Sixth Circuit, and that is what we have here. Me, opposing counsel, the judge, is not in the position to say whether or not years of constant treatment in a way affects somebody that was going through it, especially someone in the way that it was in these Title VII worlds. It is very personal, and it affects different people different ways. Now, I would also like to bring up the point that if there's a progressive discipline going on, why did we go through this? Why are they papering her? Why are they doing all these things? Why, as soon as she goes to HR, does she get her first verbal warning then? And then why, when during the termination meeting that I discussed, are they talking about the exact same thing in the August 18th meeting? After there's a meeting with HR where they refused to even discuss with her the merits of the August 18th written So she had proof, my client had proof of inaccuracies in the written, and she attempted to bring that to HR's attention. HR told her, deal with it, she's the boss. So to this day, we have verifiable proof that, if that's a word, we have verifiable proof that at least the majority of the things that she was even written up for on her only write-up are just simply not true, and the other ones are subjective. What is subjective criteria? Subjective criteria is an avenue of proving pretext. So even if we don't have direct evidence of retaliation here, by counsel's own admission, we surpass the standard necessary for our purposes, considering all facts are in our favor. Now, to answer your question, Judge Clay, about the 2017, I believe it was you, Your Honor, Judge Clay, 2017 report, it was much better. Much, much better. Now, does anybody have a perfect review? I mean, if you do, you probably need new employment because you're not challenging yourself. So there were areas of improvement. But to say that you can even compare the 2017 to 2018, it's just simply not the case. Her 2017 performance review was good. It was good. I was trying to search up on my phone to get the exact
wording. So you're saying that once the supervisor, Ms. Schaefer, returned from maternity leave, then all of a sudden the performance of Ms. Robinson, on paper at least, deteriorated?
Exactly.
Let me ask you this. Do you dispute the truth of the contention that after the company met with your client and told her what they considered to be some of her deficiencies, that final meeting, and one of which was she needed to stop leaving work early, and that as soon as that meeting was concluded, she proceeded to do just that, which is to say she left work early without permission? Did that actually happen?
Yes, sir. No, that didn't happen. My client at her deposition denied that. And that highlights our main point. We did not get the inferences necessary in the trial court, made decisions of fact that should have been left for a jury. Decide whether or not you believe Ms. Robinson, when she said, no, that didn't happen. Or you believe the other four or five pieces of paper that we can prove did not happen, that Ms. Schaefer signed, that said they did. So, and it just all comes down to your original question. It's when did these critiques start? And it's pretty clear and it's pretty obvious from the record, these critiques started only after she started meeting with HR. Because then it's take it out of. She's not thinking about this person as even take out the discriminatory intent. She is looking at this person as somebody that is trying to mess up her job, and she's trying to do everything. Ms. Schaefer's doing what she can to make sure that she is out of here. And I think we have at least showed that reasonable mind could differ to that.
I know your client has a particular perspective on the events that transpired in connection with their employment, but there seems to be most of that seems to come from her own deposition testimony. Are there any corroborating witnesses that she could offer for any of the key events pertaining to whatever disputes there were between her and the employer?
Yes, Your Honor, and I top of my head, I don't have her name. It's mentioned in my briefing. Her other female coworker, the only other female that was working in her team, who also filed a discrimination charge with HR related to her sex.
I don't know who you're referring to. Do you have a name?
I do. I briefed it, Your Honor. I'm sorry. It's in my briefing, her first and last name. I just don't. It's Kat something, I believe. I forgot her last name, though, at the top of my head, Your Honor.
What does that person claim to have witnessed?
She can testify to the allegations that my client's proving of the dissimilar treatment, the treatment of women at the workplace, all of these likes. And also, we would be able to.
Well, yes, sir. Wait a minute now. You say she can testify as to certain things. This person whose name you don't remember, did you take that person's deposition?
No, Your Honor.
Well, you can't rely upon it very much. If you think that was an important witness and you didn't depose the person, it's kind of unpersuasive for you to bring the name up at this juncture.
May I respond, Your Honor?
Certainly.
So the reason, so I would just like to first, the reason I brought it up is to respond to your question, Your Honor. I didn't mean to use that as a sword as of my proof. We can offer multiple witnesses, and we plan on doing that if we can get to trial. We just don't think for this.
But who are the witnesses? The record seems to be pretty bereft of witnesses in your client's behalf.
Your Honor.
And you didn't depose any witnesses to support her to any extent.
Your Honor, that's true, and similarly, all of the testimony that helps defendant came from Ms. Schaefer, and the testimony that helps us came from my client. And we would like to be able to put that evidence on in front of the trial court. However, in just based on our standards and where we were in summary disposition, where all facts are in our favor, disregard all evidence to the moving party, I don't think that was necessary. And as a practice tip going forward, maybe that there's some wisdom in that, Your Honor. However, for our purposes and what the law is, I don't think that was necessary.
All right. I see that you're out of time, so we thank both parties for the arguments, and the case will be submitted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.